Hello, this is Andy Bobick, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the most current March 2024 Mojo Magazine. I'm going to finish the article about the Blues Brothers with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, and then an article about the Black Crowes and their new album, and a classic album review of Oranges and Lemons by one of my favorite bands, Ecstasy. Okay, I'm going to start off with an article that I didn't get to finish last week about the Blues Brothers, titled Mission Accomplished. The dream of two comedians obsessed by blues and R&B, panned by critics but adored by generations of fans, the Blues Brothers carried a torch for their greats of the genre at the time when the music and movie industries could care less. Adapted from his new book about the film and its stars, Daniel Day Vise relates the drugs, the jeopardy, and the idealism behind a cult classic. And this is where I left off last week. Belushi and Aykroyd set about recruiting musicians. Their first hire was Steve Jordan, an SNL drummer. The brothers tapped SNL saxophonist Lou Mariani and trombonist Tom Malone. Malone recruited trumpeter Alan Rubin. For lead guitarist, they hired Matt Guitar Murphy, a blues master who had played with Howlin' Wolf. Paul Schaefer, the SNL pianist, became bandleader. To round out their Sam and Dave homage, the Blues Brothers hired Steve, the Colonel, Cropper, and Donald Duck Dunn, the guitarist and bassist, respectively, for the actual Stax House Band. The Blues Brothers' nine-day residency at Universal Amphitheater unfolded like a dream. After the first set, Dan and John pulled Jordan into their trailer and popped a bottle of Dom Perignon. A knock at the door, and Mick Jagger and Linda Ronstadt walked in. Jackson Browne, Joe Cocker, and Henry Winkler milled outside. Walter Matthau pocketed a Blues Brothers badge for his kid. That first night, Blue, Lou Mariani, stood near the edge of the stage. "And I'm out there looking at Jack Nicholson," he said, "and we're playing B Movie Box Car Blues." And he looked up at me, and he lifted up his sunglasses, and he went, "Wow." Back in New York, Belushi and Aykroyd opened a speakeasy in the basement of a four-story tenement at Hudson and Dominic Streets near the Holland Tunnel. An echo of the old 505 Club, it was a fetid, black-windowed space framed by peeling wallpaper with wet floors and a truly frightening toilet. Keith Richards and Francis Ford Coppola tended bar. The Grateful Dead raised glasses with the SNL cast. Drinks were free, and a small stage beckoned. Here, Belushi and Aykroyd would perform blues standards with a pickup band that might include David Bowie, James Taylor, or ZZ Top for an intimate audience of elite friends. Briefcase Full of Blues, the live album assembled from the Universal dates, dropped at Thanksgiving. The first pressing of 50,000 copies sold out in 1 week. By early 1979, the album was climbing toward the top of the Billboard album chart. Neither of the two post-war blues giants, B.B. King and Muddy Waters, had even cracked the top 20. Most music writers greeted the Blues Brothers album with surprising goodwill, a testament to the currency SNL still enjoyed in the counterculture. But not all were so kind. The biggest problem with the Blues Brothers wasn't Belushi's voice or Aykroyd's chops. They were two white guys fronting a mostly white band that played historically black music. In Rolling Stone, Dave Marsh theorized that the presence of Cropper and Dunn, the white Stax masters, was the only thing keeping the Blues Brothers from slopping over into racist parody. The Rock and Roll Life fed Belushi's burgeoning drug habit. One day in February 1979, Keith Richards rolled into New York. He and Belushi embarked on a coke-fueled binge. The next day, John arrived for the SNL broadcast, almost incoherent. He staggered into his dressing room, collapsed on a couch, closed his eyes, and moaned that he was too sick to go on. Someone summoned a doctor. He examined Belushi and summoned Lorne Michaels. The doctor said Belushi could not perform. His lungs were filled with fluid. He might die. "What are the odds of that?" Michaels asked. 50-50. "I can live with those odds." Belushi limped through the show, hoarse and sweating. One writer recalled it as the one and only time I ever remember John being messed up at airtime. Outside the inner circle, hardly anyone noticed. The next day, his wife Judy wrote in her diary, "John Trouble." The phenomenal success of Animal House, released in summer of 1978, elevated Belushi into an A-list movie star. Meanwhile, word spread through Hollywood of a possible Blues Brothers film. Aykroyd was toying on a mammoth script, a love letter to Chicago, Belushi, and blues. With Animal House director John Landis, he wrote parts for Aretha Franklin, James Brown, Ray Charles, Cab Calloway, and John Lee Hooker. At the close of the 1970s, some of these titans were all but forgotten. Aykroyd hoped to revere their careers, a crusade he pursued with almost religious fervor. Landis worked that theme into the script with a line he wrote for Elwood Blues, "We're on a mission from God." Universal film executives balked at some of the musicians Landis put forward. Cab Calloway and James Brown were icy cold. In place of Aretha Franklin, someone suggested Rose Royce, a funk disco group assembled to record the theme song to the hit film Car Wash. As production on the movie commenced in summer of 1979, Franklin arrived to the pre-recording of her performance at the Universal Recording Studio at Walton and Rush Streets, Chicago, with her own backup singers and her own arrangement of Think, her decade-old hit. After hearing the pre-recorded backing track, the singer announced, "I'd like to change the piano." She sat down at a Steinway and pounded out the song with an explosion of energy. By day, Belushi and Aykroyd hung out at the studio, recording the rest of the Blues Brothers soundtrack with the band. Selections including Taj Mahal's She's Caught the Katie, Spencer Davis Group's Gimme Some Lovin', and Solomon Burke's Everybody Needs Somebody to Love, along with the local anthem Sweet Home Chicago, the Elvis classic Jailhouse Rock, and the Rawhide TV theme. Paul Schaefer and Steve Jordan, unavailable for filming, were replaced by pianist Murphy Dunn and ex-Stax staple Willie Hall on drums. At night, the comedians made the rounds of Chicago blues clubs, hanging and jamming with local talent. When crowds grew too thick, the brothers would hail a police car, as if it were a cab, and catch a ride back to their temporary home, the top floors of the Astor Tower, a modernist Gold Coast high-rise that had hosted the Beatles. Cocaine was everywhere. Tom Bones Ballone recalled a sound man on the set who was the man. You could buy a gram from him for $100. Belushi fell into his usual pattern, arriving late to the set. His Wayfarers, a virtually discontinued brand that the movie's production assistants bought up from thrift stores, concealed bleary eyes, brimming with contrition. Studio executives did what they could to track his nocturnal travels. By the final week of October 1979, the Blues Brothers lagged 16 days behind schedule and millions of dollars over budget. The week started with Belushi and Aykroyd in an all-night jam with the Eagles, in town for a gig at Chicago Stadium, plus Jackson Browne. Libations flowed. Thank God they had microphones to lean on, one attendee observed. Late on the afternoon of October 25th, a chilly Thursday, Landis and crew waited on Belushi, who refused to emerge from his trailer. Landis stomped up to the Winnebago and knocked on the door. Inside, Belushi sat with hair disheveled, eyes vacant. Atop a desk sat a mound of cocaine. "John, you're killing yourself," Landis cried. "Do not do this to my movie. Don't do this to me. Don't do this to Judy. Don't do it to yourself." Belushi's head bobbled woozily. Landis scooped up the white powder, probably $100,000 worth, and flushed it down the toilet. Belushi stood, muttered, "Landis, you motherfucker," and charged at his director, trying to get to the remnants of his stash. They grappled like drunken wrestlers. Belushi wept, and their grapple melted into an embrace. Landis, too, burst into tears. "John, this is insane," he moaned. Twice that week, Belushi failed to arrive on set. Both times, Landis said, "We ended up taking the door off his room and calling the paramedics because he had basically overdosed." By the time the cast and crew of the Blues Brothers limped out of Chicago, the film star and box office draw had almost died. "Not once, but twice," Landis said, and the film was only half finished. Back in Los Angeles, the Blues Brothers crew faced a complicated shoot inside their fictional Triple Rock Church, presided over by the Reverend Cleophas James, played by James Brown. Attempting to pre-record the music, producers had found that no two takes of the Godfather's vocals sounded alike. Now they would tape him live, backed by James Cleveland's Southern California Community Choir, with a cameo from the Ascendant Chaka Khan. Brown arrived on set looking pretty spaced, music producer Bob Tischler recalled, but he whipped the flock into a frenzy on the old landmark, a blistering gospel stomper that Aretha Franklin had recorded on her Amazing Grace album. "I searched and found the fastest gospel song I could find," Aykroyd recalled. Acrobats twirled through the air, vaulting off hidden trampolines and soaring past a blue neon cross, a prop whose construction Landis had ordered in a moment of inspiration. Amid this joyous chaos, the crew received word that Aretha Franklin was coming. Unlike James Brown, Aretha Franklin had waffled on the Blues Brothers. She had never made a film, and she wasn't sure about playing a glorified waitress. Now, arriving in Los Angeles, she beheld a perfect reconstruction of a Maxwell Street diner on the Universal set. The Queen of Soul was impressed. There was only one problem. It became painfully clear she could not remember the lyrics to her famous song. Someone wrote the words on a pair of whiteboards and placed one at each end of the set so Franklin could see them at any point in the routine. But she couldn't read them without her glasses. By contrast, Ray Charles breezed through his scene in a Hollywood rebuild of Ray's Music Exchange. "I remember him laughing a lot and going to the little boy's room very frequently," said Murphy Dunn. Meanwhile, the horn section made creative use of the music shop's set glass-topped display case as Landis filmed. In one take, the musicians produced a dollar bill and pantomimed chopping out a line. In the third take, recalls Tom Malone, Alan Rubin, pulls out a gram of coke and lays it out on the glass countertop, and we start to snort it. Landis yelled, "Cut!" stormed up to the group and cried, "What the fuck are you guys doing?" One of the horns reminded the director that he had instructed them to act like musicians. When the time came for Charles to play, he and the crew found that the Rhodes electric piano had lost power. There was no time to find a new chord, so Brother Ray performed the song with assistant director David Sozna kneeling beneath him, holding two strands of bare, live electrical wire against exposed metal tabs at the keyboard's base. Every time Charles stomped on the pedals, Sozna winced. The scene would mark the on-screen debut of the full Blues Brothers band, dancing like pros. In the editing room, George Folsley cut deftly back and forth between Ray's nimble performance and impromptu dancers filmed on a Chicago street. A Robert Crumb cartoon come to life. But after all the effort, the studio didn't want the scene in the movie. Wanted me to cut in way, way down, Folsley said. Universal executives deemed Ray Charles's faded icon. Landis ignored the request. Days before the critical Hollywood Palladium shoot, the film's cinematic scene, producers received an ominous call. Belushi had been partying at someone's house in the valley. A kid rode by on a skateboard. Belushi asked if he could give it a try. He promptly fell, landing hard on his knee. An orthopedist fitted him with a knee brace he could wear beneath his black suit. The Palladium scene demanded the usual concert calisthenics from Belushi. Landis offered to swap in a stuntman. Belushi waved him off. Like so many Blues Brothers scenes, the Palladium shoot fell behind schedule. When the time came to film the final shots, the studio lacked extras to fill the seats. Producers ran an impromptu contest on a rock radio station. Many contest winners brought weed, and when the music started, they lit up. The plume of pot smoke triggered an aggressive response from the plainclothes police. Universal had hired to keep order. Police clashed with extras. Aggrieved patrons tore up Palladium bathrooms. Filmmakers had intended to shoot the film's denouncement inside Illinois Real Joliet Prison, but Landis concluded the facility's dining hall wasn't large enough for the vast musical number he hoped to stage, and had studio artists build a replica on the Universal set. In the filmed scene, the first prisoner to climb on a table is Joe Walsh, the Eagles guitarist, in a cameo. This was an easy shoot for the musicians pantomiming over a pre-recorded track. Before the cameras rolled, a few of them dropped acid. By the close of the film's production, sobriety ran in short supply. When studio executives watched the dailies from the final musical number, they asked cinematographer Stephen Katz, "Where are the close-ups?" "Close-ups?" the cinematographer scoffed. "Have you seen their eyes?" On Friday, June the 20th, 1980, the Blues Brothers opened. Landis and company braced for the reviews. They were dreadful. "Mr. Belushi and Mr. Aykroyd have only about three funny scenes during the course of a long, bloated saga," Janet Maslin opined in New York Times. The Washington Post termed the film a ponderous comic monstrosity. Even worse, to some reviewers, was the director's unthinkable decision to conceal the eyes of his stars behind impenetrable sunglasses. Worst of all, some reviewers greeted the Blues Brothers as fundamentally racist. People who love soul music and blues may have a little trouble accepting Aykroyd and Belushi as great performers in a movie that consigns the authentic greats to backup roles, David Denby wrote in New York Magazine. Belushi and Aykroyd doubtless intended to pay homage to the great black performers who have inspired them, but the homage often comes close to insult and outright ripoff. The only praise seemed to come from Chicago. Take your pick, Gene Siskel wrote in the Tribune. The Blues Brothers is the year's best film to date, one of the all-time great comedies, the best movie ever made in Chicago. All are true, and boy, is that ever a surprise. Moviegoers agreed. The Blues Brothers earned $4.9 million in its first weekend and $7.9 million in its first week, more than $1 million a day. Only The Empire Strikes Back was doing better business. On July 16th, Variety reported that the Blues Brothers had earned $25.7 million in 24 days, maintaining its blockbuster pace. On Friday, June the 27th, the Blues Brothers, the band, with Jordan and Schaefer restored, went on tour, 25 shows in 13 cities. Belushi cleaned up admirably. He still wasn't much of a singer, but in concert, his showmanship prevailed. Reviewers wrestled with the paradox. The band traveled from Chicago to the Palladium in New York. Warm reviews followed the band through Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. On Saturday, July 26, they opened a week-long valedictory stand at Universal Amphitheater in Los Angeles. No one knew it then, but Belushi and Aykroyd would not perform as the Blues Brothers again. And John Belushi would never make another great movie, with Dan Aykroyd or without him. He died on March the 5th, 1982, inside Bungalow 3, a two-bedroom, $200-a-night suite at Chateau Marmont in Los Angeles. He had overdosed on a speedball administered by groupie and singer Kathy Smith. In 1986, she would be sentenced to 3 years in prison for involuntary manslaughter. In the years that followed, the Blues Brothers would ascend from maligned hit to cult classic to important film. Its critical currency rose alongside the stature of its stars. By the new millennium, critics and historians recognized Saturday Night Live as one of television's great achievements and the Belushi-Aykroyd ensemble as its greatest cast. The film gained further gravitas as arguably the finest work of John Landis, one of America's great comedic directors, and as a big, noisy, noir Valentine to the city of Chicago. Finally, the Blues Brothers earned immortality as a priceless artifact of American music. The brothers and their director didn't know it in 1979, but their paper-thin SNL spinoff, their one-joke skit turned big-budget film, would stand as perhaps the finest cinematic showcase for several of the greatest musical artists of the century. One August weekend in 2022, 5,000 fans watched Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi's brother Jim perform with the Blues Brothers Band at Old Gillette Prison in the inaugural Blues Brothers Con. Patrons lined up to purchase memorabilia at the same counter where Jake Blues had once collected his broken digital watch and used prophylactic. In a photograph from the event, captured by a Chicago Tribune photographer, Aykroyd gazed out at the crowd with the same beatific smile he had worn as he watched John Lee Hooker sing Boom Boom on Maxwell Street, his crazy blues dream made manifest. And now I'm going to move on to the article about the Black Crowes, titled Sometimes Salvation. As famed for their stormy sibling rivalry, as for their soulful rock extraplantations, the Black Crowes seem dead and buried, the grave trampled by wronged and resentful ex-members. But now the brothers Robinson are back with a new album and, they claim, a new attitude. In order to do this properly, we had to not be dicks, they tell Mark Blake. Phil Lynott points his bass guitar like a machine gun at Chris Robinson's head. The framed photograph of Thin Lizzy's main man in attack mode hangs on a wall in the vocalist house in Marin County, California. And I also have Darby Crash right here, says Robinson, showing Mojo a picture of the Germs' doomed singer. The Rolling Stones' signature tongue appears in the crook of Robinson's elbow as he pulls up his sleeve to reveal the pothead pixie from Gong's Flying Teapot album cover. A memento of the psychedelic world we were living in, he offers, with a lopsided grin. The photographs and body art are testament to Chris Robinson's fascination with rock and roll in all its forms. A few days earlier, he took the plunge and saw Depeche Mode at the LA Forum. I never listened to them in the 80s because I was so obsessed with guitar music, but it was one of the best fucking shows I've ever seen. It's a far cry from the last century. In 1990, the Black Crowes' debut album, Shake Your Money Maker, catapulted their fresh, youthful take on vintage rock into the U.S. top five. But the enfant terrible Robinson already had a reputation for derailing rival acts and calling out their corporate paymasters. No, I don't have regrets, the 56-year-old says, when he recalls comparing Limp Bizkit's Fred Durst to a G.I. Joe doll and Britney Spears to Barbie. But it feels like we were the last generation to have opinions. I figured it was my right to say these things, but really, I was trying to be funny at the expense of other people's shit, which was immature. Chris and his younger guitar-playing sibling, Rich, talk a lot about maturity. After all, it was their shit that derailed the group. By 2015, the last time they broke up, the Black Crowes had enjoyed 9 U.S. Top 30 albums, including the number one, The Southern Harmony, and Musical Companion, and connected with an audience that extended far beyond hard rock fans. But their internal dynamic, always toxic, had been untenable. The Robinsons told everyone that this time it was over for good, except it wasn't. In 2019, the brothers announced a reunion tour to celebrate Shake Your Money Maker's 30th birthday, which they performed with a band shorn of previous members. Now, rejoined by bassist Sven Pepien, a collaborator from 1997 onwards, they're posed to release a new album, Happiness Bastards. In order to do this properly, we had to not be dicks, says 54-year-old Rich from his home in Nashville, Tennessee. We had to rewire the whole thing and say, okay, we don't have time for bullshit. We have to get back to what we love. In 1985, the teenage Robinsons were living in Moretta, a suburb of Atlanta, Georgia, and playing in Mr. Crow's garden. Sven Pipien's first encountered them at a Battle of the Bands held in the local Catholic girls' school. Mr. Crow's garden beat my group, and even then, Chris had something he was already projecting. It was a rare moment of validation for Chris. When we were teenagers, I didn't know if I could sing, he says. I was encouraged. My dad was a singer, and he thought I was talentless. Maybe he was on to something. I don't know. Stan Robinson had scored a modest rockabilly hit with 1959's Boom a Dip Dip before becoming a clothing sales rep. His Dylan and Buffalo Springfield records later became his Offspring's gateway drug. Then we found our own musical identity, says Rich. R.E.M. were huge in the South, and we discovered the Cramps, the DBs, the Dead Kennedys. The song Flesh Wound, Unhappiness Bastards, sounds like a throwback to something Mr. Crow's Garden might have played at Atlanta's White Dot Club in the mid-80s. It's got that desperate feeling I used to get when I listened to X, suggest Rich. And here's a little bit of that song, Flesh Wound, from the Black Crowes album, Happiness Bastards. In 1987, the group poached drummer Steve Gorman from Pippian's group, Marry My Hope, and the music started to evolve. I remember picking Sven up in my little car to sign the lease on a house we were renting together, says Chris. Sven was a Clove cigarette-smoking Doors fan, and his band were into acid way before us. I stuck on a cassette of the Flying Burrito Brothers, and he was like, "Why are you listening to fucking country music?" Mr. Crow's Garden signed to Deaf American in 89, where their producer, George Drakoulis, encouraged the name change and introduced them to his bountiful collection of Led Zeppelin, Stones, and Humble Pie LPs. The Crows, now completed by guitarist Jeff Cease and bassist Johnny Colt, reemerged with flowing locks and a retro shabby chic wardrobe. Their new sound was classic rock reimagined through the prism of punk and indie, and with a touch of fucking country music. "It took me a while to understand," admits Pippian. "At first it seemed absurd, kind of silly. Mr. Crow's Garden always had a hard edge, but they were an artsy band. Then Rich gave me a demo of Shake Your Money Maker, and I went, okay, this is making sense now." Everything happened fast. The band went from club dates to opening for AC/DC, Robert Plant, Aerosmith, and ZZ Top. Their debut album sold 3 million within 12 months, and its limber cover of Otis Redding's Hard to Handle and the ballad She Talks to Angels breached the American Top 30. And here's a little bit of the song, Hard to Handle, from the Black Crowes off their debut album, Shake Your Money Maker.
Calls the mama, I'm sure all the hand and I just around. Ever. calls her mama. I'm so hard to handle now, just around.
Maybe he was overcompensating, but Chris Robinson amplified his bratty rock star persona and started calling out anyone or anything that didn't adhere to his idealistic view of rock and roll. The Black Crowes are guilty of never kissing anybody's motherfucking ass, he declared. We were immature, says Rich, but it was a crazy time. I was 19, graduated high school, and a year later made Shake Your Moneymaker. No one can prepare you for success, so we ran away. In March 1991, the Crowes were dumped from ZZ Top's arena jaunt after Chris slagged off the tour sponsor, Miller Lite, on stage. Soon he was back in the press, damning chart-topping pop stars, New Kids on the Block, as talentless pricks. A lot of my comments during that time came out of being in a depression, he claims. Back then, no one cared if you were depressed and had to go on a press tour. If I have a tinge of regret, it would be the way I came across as so outspoken in the media and how that became the headline more than how good the music was. The Crowes' music was also misunderstood. Critics fixated on the band's southern roots, but theirs were radio-free Europe, not Freebird. We never sounded like fucking Lynyrd Skynyrd, laughs Chris. The Stones? Yeah, I get it. But, oh, you guys sound like the Faces. We didn't, really. We just wore flares. Sometimes the Crowes' single-mindedness was a blessing. They refused label boss Rick Rubin's suggestion that they perform in front of a Confederate flag, and sometimes a curse. Whenever we put a record out, we ran away from it. Even Shake Your Moneymaker, admits Rich. We got an arena tour with Aerosmith, and the first night we opened with a new song, a slow 10-minute dirge. The people around us were saying, "What are you doing?" And we're like, "But we wrote a new song. We think it's cool." We didn't understand how it worked. Future Guns N' Roses guitarist Mark Ford replaced Jeff Cease for 1992's The Southern Harmony and Musical Companion, a gumbo of blues, gospel, and hard rock that went top five in the UK and the US without a hit single. In the pantheon of our shit, Shake Your Moneymaker is the big one, but Southern Harmony is the best one, believes Chris. When we did the Southern Harmony box set, December 2023, George Draculis listened to Remedy and sometimes Salvation and said, "You know, this is pretty unique music. It's rock and roll, but it didn't sound like what everybody else was doing. We just let the music grow." The music didn't stop growing. 1994's Amerika took 2 years and $80,000 worth of abandoned recording sessions, including a whole other unreleased album. The group blamed the excess on Chris's escalating drug use, his expanding ego, and an obsession with their new touring partners, the Grateful Dead. Anyone who interviewed the brothers back then experienced their tense dynamic. There'd be Chris holding forth, sprawled like a velvet-clad praying mantis on a hotel bed, while a stony-faced Rich sat on the other side of the room, interjecting whatever his brother paused for breath. In 2019, Rich told this writer that the Crowes nearly broke up four times while making Amerika, and I nearly kicked the shit out of Chris multiple times. Chris and Rich were always fighting, says Pipian. But as soon as you picked a side, the other one would jump straight in and defend his brother. Amerika was a super strong record, declares Chris. but Walmart and the other chain stores refused to stock it because of the cover's model's thong and pubic hair. That record was about excess, though. That image was saying, look how gratuitous and gross we are in America. We don't have love, we have this. It wasn't meant to be like a sexy thing. It's hard not to hear Spinal Tap, bemused Nigel Tufnell. What's wrong with being sexy? And Chris's explanation. But it was typical of his mindset. The brothers thought the Black Crowes was the sun and the industry was the planets, wrote Steve Gorman in 2019's whistleblowing memoir, Hard to Handle. Chris Robinson is now married to artist Camille Johnson and no longer trying to take his brother's share of the Black Crowes. I call my time away the wilderness years, he says quietly. I was really resentful and angry about the Black Crowes, and I went through some pretty rough spots in personal relationships. During this second hiatus, Chris formed the folky, whimsical Chris Robinson Brotherhood, and Rich bounced between solo projects and a new ensemble, the Magpie Salute, whose lineup included Mark Ford and Sven Pippian. Yet neither brother could match what they achieved together. There was pathos, too, in Chris performing Black Crowes songs in a new group, As the Crow Flies, in 2018. A year later, the Robinsons announced the Shake Your Moneymaker Anniversary Tour, which was postponed until 2021 by the pandemic. What prompted the reunion? Well, it was simple. I'd written some songs and thought, I'd love to hear my brother sing them, replies Rich. I mentioned this to a friend of ours who's neutral and knows how to navigate between us. He told me Chris had called him and said the same. We didn't rush into anything, but it opened the door. There is no diminishing my wife Camille's role in breaking down a lot of resentments and anger, offers Chris. My wife is a rock and roll woman, and she opened my eyes up again, like, what's the fucking problem here? I'd been guilty. Our dad passed away a decade ago, but I wasn't friendly with anyone and wasn't even speaking to my mom. The Robinson offspring also had a hand in the family reunion. Chris has two children. Rich has seven, and five of them are under 13, says the guitarist wearily. They're like, what's up with Uncle Chris? What's up with that guy? Kids take no prisoners. Initially, none of the other ex-members were asked to join the reunion. The current Crowes lineup is completed by guitarist Nico Burkinara, keyboard player Eric Deutsch, and drummer Brian Griffin. Meanwhile, Steve Gorman's book seems to have made him persona non gravita. I don't think we could bring in the negative influence, says Chris. I can't be responsible for the other people that have been in this band and whatever they wanted to get out of it or whatever their level of self-importance or desperation. I can only be responsible for Rich and I, and Rich and I are blood. I had a range of emotions with Steve writing that book, says Pippian, who rejoined for the third time in 2021. I couldn't begin to talk about some of the things Steve talked about because it's private stuff with my friends. Then to cash in on it and then blame the brothers for cashing in. That's a triple whammy. As much as I love Steve and always will, it was hard to swallow. Performing Shake Your Money Maker live reminded Chris Robinson of what once made the Black Crowes so vital. We went in a million different directions after that straight-ahead rock and roll record. Now we were playing the same record every night, and after a week, I realized a little grease paint and sparkles and showbiz is good. Happiness Bastard sounds a lot like the early Black Crowes and is named after a novel by the San Francisco beat poet Kirby Doyle. "I'm an obsessive reader," says Chris, "but the title's meant to be funny. Don't take everything so seriously. It's a love letter to rock and roll. If that's not too much of a cliche." "We're not rehashing anything," he adds, "but it was amazing to get Rich and I working again. Although we'd have our hands on each other's throats on tour, it's different when it's just us in a room with guitars and writing songs. We're grown men now, and we had to get the fuck out of our own way and let the vibes be the vibes. We need to do this right," states Rich, "because I really don't want to fight and bullshit and break up again." Considering these words, what advice would they give their own touring partners, the still estranged Gallagher brothers? "Well, I'd say the same thing Noel said to me after Chris and I got in a big fight once," replies Rich. He pauses, and Mojo half expects to hear a Manchurian accent, but it doesn't come. Noel said, "Look, man, your brother is your brother. You just have to let him be." Maybe, finally, the Black Crowes have learned to stop running away. And here's another song off the Black Crowes' new album, Happiness Bastards, titled Rats and Clowns. Classic album review this week is Oranges and Lemons by one of my favorite bands, Ecstasy. 1989. 9 albums in, and Ecstasy aren't getting any worse. Artistically and commercially rejuvenated following the cult success of Skylarking, Ecstasy were happy to capitalize on the burgeoning stateside success by returning to the U.S. with a keen, young American producer, Paul Fox, who had impressed with his Culture Club and Yes remixes. With a budget that allowed for families to accompany Ecstasy, decamped to Los Angeles for 5 months. Having been kept on a short leash during Skylarking by Todd Rundgren, Partridge's expansive imagination was given more room by the relatively inexperienced Fox, and the sessions dragged on beyond the patience of the musicians' families, who returned to Swindon after 2 months, not to mention Virgin, who threatened to pull the plug as the album went £30,000 over budget. Also, the band were in dispute with their former manager, and Andy was drinking heavily, morbidly dwelling on the pointlessness of future income, given the ongoing litigation. Unusually, he relished the mix to Fox, flying home to recuperate. In the end, Oranges and Lemons was a startling record, which in contrast to the misleading Yellow Submarine cover, fizzes with timeless pop energy and weighty invention. From the eastern metal romp of Garden of Earthly Delights, the effortless juggling of the baby penis metaphor on the sly and breezy Pink Thing, the life-giving destructive evolution of himself as a miniature sun, to the awe-inspiring Wilson-esque achievement of Chalk Hills and Children. It's Partridge's show, and he fills it full of showstoppers. Though Maldine's solid songs keep their customary cool among impossibly vibrant company. "I Won't Rock the Boat," he sings, significantly in One of the Millions. And here's a little bit, one of my favorite songs on that album, Oranges and Lemons by Ecstasy, Garden of Earthly Delights. Long since allergic to Ecstasy's vulgar prowess, virtually ignored the album, but the states were more receptive, even tempting the stage-weary Partridge out on a radio tour and pre-unplugged acoustic TV appearances. With Partridge's performing, juices flowing again, Tarquin Gotch, Ecstasy's then manager, had one last attempt to get the band on some proper money-spinning live shows. He fabricated the idea with Dave and Collins' connivance of a tour as Ecstasy with Thomas Dolby taking Partridge's place. "Andy, I had actually suggested they tour without me. But when he said, 'Look, we'll get someone in who looks a bit like you and who's got a bit of a name,' that really put my nose out of joint. I said, 'Well, perhaps I could come on for a couple of numbers towards the end.' And he said, 'Come on for the whole fucking set, you idiot.'" Tarquin Gotch retired gracefully, wished Ecstasy well, and left them to their cult status. And here's another one of my favorite tracks off that album, Oranges and Lemons, "The Mayor of Simpleton."
Oh,
unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the March 2024 Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article about the band The Pogues and their frontman who died in December of 2023, Shane McGowan. And also an article titled Magnificent 70s. And a classic album review next week of Aqualung by Jethro Tull. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rockin'.